Host Dr. Indra Ekman is here. Before we start this episode, a note that the discussion you are about to hear was recorded on February 16th, before Vladimir Putin launched a Russian military assault on Ukraine in the early hours of Thursday, February 24th. The conversation focuses largely on theoretical and geopolitical considerations related to Ukraine and Eastern Europe. But at the outset, I want to acknowledge that this war is not taking place in a theoretical plane, but has real consequences for the lives of people on the ground. The human cost of conflict is never to be ignored. Thanks for listening. Welcome to Baltic Ways, a podcast bringing you interviews and insights from the world of Baltic studies. Today, we listen to a conversation with Dr. Maria Melkso. Dr. Melkso is a senior researcher at the University of Copenhagen's Center for Military Studies, and before that taught at the University of Kent's Brussels School of International Studies and the University of Tartu. Dr. Melkso's research interests include security, deterrence, and small states and alliance politics and NATO. We speak about the ever-pressing question of agency in Ukraine and the Baltic states, and Central and Eastern European scholarship in international security studies. Stay tuned. Dr. Melkso, it's really a pleasure to speak with you, and thank you so much for joining me on Baltic Ways. Perhaps we can start and you can tell us a little bit about your background and some of the current research you are working on.
Thank you very much for having me, Indra. Always there is this question, where does one start and where do our stories start? My background is in Estonia. I'm Estonian, and I still continue also working on themes that are at least in some way related to things that I think are still relevant, continue to be of relevance for Estonia and the other Baltic states, and perhaps more broadly for the region, Central East European region in general. So I was born in Estonia. I did my undergraduate degrees there. And then my academic journey took me for my graduate studies to England, but also I did an interesting undergraduate exchange year in Montana, which was also an interesting eye-opening experience. Then I came back after my doctoral degree to Estonia and worked there at the University of Tartu for quite some years, and then left for Belgium for another interesting in-between academic institution, an academic outpost of a British university in Brussels, where I worked for 5 years, and now I'm at the University of Copenhagen. So that's the sort of institutional. And now the sort of academic journey has, of course, as all academic journeys do, had its twists and turns, but I think the Baltic leitmotif has always been there. But I've always tried to also think about it and put it in the context of both broader regional issues and perhaps also knowledge hierarchy issues in European studies and in international relations theory more generally. So I guess I probably could not really be considered a Baltic studies scholar, but a scholar who, you know, has a keen interest, of course, in the political realities in international relations of the Baltic states.
Yeah, thank you for that background. You know, we're speaking today on February 16th, and for the last several months, Russia has been amassing troops on its border with Ukraine. This, of course, plays into questions about NATO and Eastern European security more generally, and intersects with a number of areas of your own work. I wonder if you can speak a little bit about your perceptions, as well as the question of agency in this international security discourse. For example, who is speaking for Ukraine in this context?
Yeah, that's a very important question. And obviously, I mean, it's a constellation of issues we can't possibly cover. I mean, I think there are some interesting parallels to what has been going on and what we have all been observing and in a way have been immersed in the past few weeks. Interesting parallels to what is known in the history of the Second World War as the phony war, right? We have had this, you know, one side, of course, saying that, well, nothing is happening, even though, you know, they are amassing troops, you know, on the borders of Ukraine and using all sorts of blackmailing and, you know, ugly rhetoric that isn't really part of the comilfo diplomatic exchanges in Europe, at least. And then the other side, the United States, very openly sort of reporting the world about what it knows so that nobody would be caught by surprise, as perhaps was the case more in 2014. Now, in terms of agency, of course, I'm not the only one in the Baltic States or in Eastern Europe more generally having horribly mixed feelings in that regard, because on the one hand, obviously, you know, there is no doubt about who is the aggressor here and who is being actively victimized here. But there is also the question of when does agency start? And of course, there is a question in Ukraine's case of missed opportunities in a way, being sort of too large for its own good, if you will, in terms of not having been so agile. And so also decisive in its political direction at the time when there was more of the chance to actually act on, you know, the choices than there is a chance to act on its choices right now. So the question of agency is always somewhat of a bound agency. There is a point in those such as, you know, Putin suggesting that sovereignty is obviously also never, you know, an absolute thing, and it's always sort of somewhat contextually bound. Now, the problem, of course, for Ukraine is that we are not anymore used to having so sort of flagrantly, so openly, so blatantly being denied the basic sovereignty as Russia is currently trying to deny Ukraine and its choices in terms of, you know, with whom it wants to politically associate with, right? So this is a horrible tragedy in that sense to observe. And also it's something that really makes one understand very palpably the tragic condition in international relations, which has been, you know, as some would argue, very characteristic to the region at large, but is striking us maybe so hard because we also see that Russia is able, willing, and ready in terms of, you know, its regime, right? In terms of its leadership. I'm not, you know, speaking for the country and the society as such. You know, its regime is ready to do things, that is, to wage war for its interests' sake, which is not something that the West, broadly conceived, actually is ready to do anymore. And this, in a way, puts, you know, the West in the situation where you would be, you know, when we compare to the analogy of terrorists, right? They are willing to use the weaponry that we are really not willing to use anymore. And they know that. And that also, you know, doesn't put one in a very, very strong negotiating position, obviously. But of course, you know, if one tries to sort of detach a bit emotionally from this, you know, unfolding, or it's not really anymore unfolding. I mean, it's been mulling and simmering and then now really heating up type of crisis. And I guess one can also see many illustrations, if you will, to various sort of core issues in international relations theory, international security studies, such as, for instance, deterrence, how one starts, actually, how one practices deterrence. And I think the West is very creatively trying to invent new ways of deterrence and put them into practice, such as, you know, doing deterrence mostly via diplomatic means, sending all sorts of envoys, all sorts of delegates to both Russia and to Ukraine and to be physically present in Ukraine. But at times also, I guess this is one of the challenges for any regional international relations scholar. It is, as you know, exciting and compelling it might be intellectually to observe all these conundrums and things as they evolve, it's somehow also deeply disturbing at an emotional level, both, you know, for its obvious potential human cost and both for the fact that I mentioned phony war in the beginning. You know, it might be phony for us in the West, broadly speaking, but it's not really phony for those who actually live under the pressure of this basically encirclement military, political, diplomatic, and obviously, you know, who is suffering is Ukraine. And I think, again, you know, in terms of this analogy, it's worthwhile to remember that it might have been a phony war back in 39-40 for the first part of the Second World War on the Western Front, but it seriously and certainly wasn't phony for the Eastern European countries, Poland in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. The human cost and the human toll emotionally is significant to bear in mind. You know, the events of 2014 in Ukraine ushered in this sort of watershed, or I told you so moment, from NATO members in Eastern Europe and from the Baltic states and Poland in particular, which materialized in this enhanced forward presence, boosting NATO visibility in the region with multinational battalion-sized battle groups. It strikes me as a little bit ironic in some ways that this deterrence measure, this defensive posture of the alliance, in some ways is one of the things on which Russia is blaming its current aggression.
Yeah, I guess, you know, deterrence is the practice of dissuading the other, right? It's a game of perceptions. And basically, it's a psychological game as much as it is a strategic and military and political one, which, of course, means that, you know, as in a case of security dilemma in general, that, you know, whatever we do in order to be or feel secure might not be read the same way by our respective other, by our respective antagonist or enemy, or the one who does not identify as our friend. So in that sense, I think we also have to distinguish between the sort of strategic significance of such forward placements and, of course, their symbolic significance. Now, any military person would probably agree that the strategic significance and the sort of military value in terms of actually being able to counter full-scale invasion from the east of these prepositioned NATO forces would not really be very, very salient or very massive, right? They are the tripwire type of forces, but they are symbolically very significant. And Russia, of course, is also, you know, understanding that. And of course, doesn't like precisely for this symbolic salience that these troops have, because the basic logic is that, you know, they in a way give the material palpability to, you know, the promise that, you know, if you cut into the body of one of the NATO collective, and if you do that around these vulnerable, more exposed Baltic fringes, then you actually, you know, cut into the whole of the alliance, and you will face the consequences from the whole of the alliance. So it's in a way, you could say, the material performance of Article 5, at least in theory. Again, of course, you know, nobody knows how it actually will play out in practice, because also, as we all know, in order to do the work in terms of actual material effects, they need to be reinforced. And in order for them to be reinforced, you know, the reinforcements need to get in place. From Russia's perspective, obviously, it seems that they also provide Russia, of course, now with a convenient excuse. From the military point of view, this is very much a sort of dug-up excuse. But, you know, that is not to deny their symbolic significance and value, and, of course, some sort of practical value. It's a huge change when one compares to what was there in terms of NATO presence before 2014, which is not very much, besides the air policing. And of course, again, you know, this is clearly very visible as a symbol of commitment and of, you know, readiness to respond more decisively in the language that it seems Russia prefers and understands, that is, you know, the language of actual sort of steps on the ground and force, if you will. So that's why it, of course, also bothers them. But again, you could say that, you know, this is one of these traps that one can see Russia has very beautifully contributed to itself, starting with 2008 in Georgia. And then, of course, nothing galvanized NATO to put its actual sort of physical allied forces in the region more than the annexation of Crimea and the follow-up in eastern Ukraine did.
Right, and Russia's incursion into Ukraine also pushed Ukrainian popular opinion more towards NATO, right? You know, we talked about the phony war, the war that wasn't so phony on the Eastern Front. And I'm thinking about the framing of Eastern Europe, which is often as this sort of site of contestation for great power politics. That's something that can cut a little bit as a double-edged sword. On the one hand, having attention helps to sort of galvanize security guarantees, maybe. But on the other, it also reinforces this portrayal of small states as needing to be recipients of things like security, Europeanization, democratization. And I wonder where you see the Baltic states in particular going forward. Is there a point in time when the Baltic countries are producers of security, of Europeanization, when they're democracy promoters? Or perhaps that's already happening?
Well, I think, you know, it is sporadically already happening, and not least in the current crisis, where actually, you know, I think we have seen a pretty vocal and straightforward messaging also coming from the region. And obviously, I mean, it's a dubious subject position to be in. There is no doubt about that, that in a way your sort of diplomatic and political highlight is at the time when you will be, you know, potentially the next victim, or you will have some, you know, knowledge of value in terms of explaining to those less experienced, you know, with this difficult neighbor, you know, how to read it or how to engage with it, or how to deal with it, right? So there is nothing particularly enviable in the subject position, and it's not one that is often very much full of agency. You are sort of always defined and determined by this fact of in-betweenness, and by this also the role of you know, translator in a way. But, you know, if that is the case, considering in crude realist terms, our location, our size, that is our as the Baltic nations and states, our history and neighborhoods, all that considered, I think we have still fared remarkably well. So if it takes to be a sort of creative translator, and that is the survival ticket, then I take it, and I think it's good enough. Obviously, it would be nice to, you know, not to have to speak for the right of existence, or to sort of even think or live in that intensely existentialist terms all the time. But it is what it is. So yeah. I guess we have to live with that, and to try to also cherish what we have. You know, in that sense, one can also see that indeed the very intense period, the very wise choices, and the also the windows that opened in the 1990s, and that of course now, you know, Russia very woundedly says, you know, they have been betrayed about in terms of the promises given and not kept by the West and by NATO in particular about enlargement and so on, which is also, you know, not consistent and actually not all true. And is a huge academic debate, of course, as well between various international historians. But that also shows that, you know, there are these lucky windows, I guess, where certain stars align, certain sort of structural conditions make something possible. But in order to actually capture that momentum, and in order to capitalize on this window of opportunity, somebody had to have exercised agency. And I think, you know, by and large, the Baltics did do that. Now, of course, you know, it becomes the sort of constant lesson of not letting it to fade away and then sort of keeping it going, right? You know, structurally, we are in a better position than ever before. Again, in comparison to Ukraine or in comparison to Belarus, you know, basically, we didn't start from a fundamentally very different platform in 1991. Okay, obviously, you know, there is the pre-war or inter-war difference in terms of how, you know, long the independent moment was there for the respective nations. But we can see from this comparison that it could go very much differently. And then, you know, the structural conditions might not be there for another, I don't know, 50 years.
Yeah, right. And it often strikes me to read, particularly in American sort of commentary around the expansion of NATO, this sort of, original sin, if you will, of provoking Russia in the 1990s really sort of eliminates the agency of the Baltic states and Eastern Europe in this discourse when they were actually making those determinative moves towards the alliance.
Yeah, and I think we should also not forget that. I mean, this is one thing that has also got very much lost in this recent Russian or Putin's rhetoric about, NATO pressing forward with enlargement. I mean, NATO or the United States was never pressing forward with the enlargement to the Baltics. I mean, we know the story very well. If anyone was pressing with it, it was these, countries and elites themselves. And NATO and the US had to be pressed into this decision, not vice versa. So, I mean, this is also very much indicative of this type of thinking that Russia very strongly has demonstrated now in case of Ukraine, that basically has a system of fully sovereign nations and then more or less semi-sovereign ones that are not really on par with the likes of Russia and the US and maybe a handful of European nations, but perhaps not even then.
Your work touches not only on the agency of states, but also on the role of the researcher. And I'd love to take a step back and think a little bit about knowledge production and the idea of post-communism as post-colonialism, and how knowledge is produced by Baltic and Central and Eastern European scholars, what they are saying, and how they are being heard and listened to, or perhaps spoken for.
Thank you for this question. This is something I've had recently quite a few debates with my colleagues about, and we recently also convened a special issue with colleagues from the Central and East European International Studies Association, which not, of course, exclusively on the Baltic, but more broadly in the Central and East European context, reflected on that, what is the place of, these countries, but also of the regional scholars, regional affiliated scholarship vis-a-vis, producing knowledge about the region and also the region's place in international relations. And of course, the observations that we made are not terribly optimistic in the sense that if you read, for instance, the big international relations, international security studies, scholarly journals, then generally the region and the regional states end up being the objects that are being discussed as security problems, more or less over their heads rather than engaged as equal interlocutors. So the typical problems that you would have, of course, less so than, maybe the case with, research projects where scholars in Europe look for local informants in less developed countries, so to speak. But still, the hierarchies, of course, always come from somewhere. I mean, they are, historically conditioned. They are also still structurally sustained in the sense that anyone who has to survive in Central and East European academic institutions knows that it is not an easy task because you really have to be very full of stamina in order to do that successfully because of the lack of basic research funding. And it's difficult to flourish without that type of support, particularly, for early career scholars who really need also the ability to link to their peers, to link to, various colleagues, build their networks, go to the conferences. And if that is not, an option, then basically one is already destined to living this sort of rather insular existence, which is not conducive for practicing international relations, right? So there are these issues there, and obviously there are also patterns that one might get a bit depressed about when you look at the funding patterns, for instance, that always tend to show that there is a serious skewing to the detriment of the Central and East European scholars. But I think it is gradually changing. I mean, obviously this is also in our character because we are the children of these times where things were changing extremely fast. almost like overnight. And one can get a false impression that this is the normal way of doing things. I think it's still an exception, and things usually take time. I try to comfort myself with this Václav Havel reminder that this is also maybe a little bit communist to think that we can plan the changes very fast and promptly and make them happen very quickly. We need a little bit of patience.
Mm-hmm. And the inclusion of those scholars is not only to the benefit of the scholars themselves, but to the field in general, right?
Absolutely, because it's not just a sort of, you know, ethical issue, this imbalance that has been there historically and that needs to be somehow not, you know, turned over, but somehow at least reflected on and adjusted. But it's also an empirical issue. You miss out a big chunk of the world if you do not manage to include the insights from this part of the world and precisely, you know, the insights that have grown up in this interesting in-between condition and therefore have, you know, some experience and some ability to speak across these various borders also.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dr. Monks, I really have appreciated this conversation. Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure, and I hope we, you know, meet at some point in person.
Thank you for tuning in to Baltic Ways, a podcast from the Association for the Advancement of Baltic Studies, produced in partnership with the Baltic Initiative at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. A note that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the authors and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AABS or FPRI. I'm your host, Dr. Indra Ekmanis. Subscribe to our newsletters at aabs-balticstudies.org and fpri.org/Baltic-initiative for more from the world of Baltic studies. Thanks for listening. See you next time.